when I realized who was here tonight, it struck me that in a way this talk is probably mostly preaching to the converted. So I was thinking, I guess, of the last Sunday sit and who was here. So if you feel like you know all this already, apologies, or I hope it's a somewhat useful refresher or a slightly different take on it. It's going to end up being a couple suggestions about how to sit with koans, though I won't quite start there. So I'll start obliquely with a little thing from, the whole short case of the Blue Cliff record, case 45, and I'll get to the koans later, right? So a monk asks Zhaozhou, the 10,000 things return to one, where does the one return to? We also have that as part of our miscellaneous koans. A monk asks Zhaozhou, the 10,000 things return to one, where does the one return to? Zhaozhou said, when I was living in the province of Qingzhou, I made a cloth robe. It weighed 7 pounds. Yuan Wu, so the Blue Cliff record is compiled by Shui Do, and then Yuan Wu, who's about a generation later, writes most of the commentary there. So the 10,000 things return to one, where does the one return to? Zhaozhou said, when I was living in the province of Qingzhou, I made a cloth robe. It weighed 7 pounds. Yuan Wu comments, some people carried a load of chan to Zhaozhou's place, but when they got there, they couldn't make any use of it. So that's a great koan. What I'm interested in, especially though, is a later commentary to it, which has got the kind of oblique relation to it, and that's from the expose-like, sort of the Michael Wolff and Trump's presidency title of Secrets of the Blue Cliff Record. But what that is actually just two great commentaries, one by Hakuin and one by the 18th century Japanese Soto teacher, Denke, right? And so Denke is commenting on one or two lines of Shui Do's poem, and I'll read you three of the four lines of the poem as a context. Shui Do writes, how many people know the weight of the 7-pound shirt? Right now, I throw it down into West Lake, the pure wind of unburdening, to whom should it be imparted? So it seems to me at least one of the reversals here moves from inside the koan, returning to the one, to the sort of flipping back into the thinginess of the 7-pound robe, and that now in the poem, in a way, Shui Do flips it again so that the robe is thrown onto the lake and floats or becomes an image, but at any rate loses some of its weightiness. So there's this kind of flip that Shui Do's made. And here's what Denke says. Now it's cast into West Lake. This monk's view of all things returning to one, needless to say, but even Zhaozhou's 7-pound shirt, too, somehow seemed to be hiding something. So Secho, which is the Japanese for Shui Do, so Shui Do throws it down on West Lake, showing a realm of untrammeled freedom with a wave of his hand. If there's anything else, it's only the clear breeze on the journey back. Even this ungraspable clear breeze, whispering invisibly, is something one would like to share with someone who aspires to it. Is there any giving or taking this? Is it something that can be gotten? Is it something that can be given? Does it belong to Secho? Whose house has no bright moon or clear breeze? Fundamentally, there couldn't be any giving or taking, you know. This is the eye to turn this side around and throw it onto the other side. So I think there, Denke is talking not only about that reversal that's inside the poem, you know, of the one turning into the thinginess of the 7-pound rope and then thrown back into the lake, but also, you know, is it his? Is it yours? Is it mine? Whose is it? Where is each of us in relation to this gift? What I like especially and where I want to come down is that strange phrase, this is the eye. When you talk about the eye of the koan, you're saying this is the another one thing would be the heart of the koan. This is the eye to turn this side around and throw it onto the other side. And what I like is that gesture of taking something and throwing it onto or throwing it over to the other side. It seems pretty clear to me that one of the key things that happens in Chan or Zen is this throwing over to the other side of setting up an opposition and then undoing it, or destabilizing or fuzzying up an opposition. There are a couple places in the koans where Denke says, kind of elaborates on it, and so after he says, excuse me, I throw it over to the other side, then he says, what other side? Other side of what? Which is really disconcerting. So, you know, there's an opposition and they'll say, I throw it over to the other side, and then actually, what other side? Other side of what? And that whole oppositional structure begins really to dissolve. And as we've been saying for quite a while now, pretty clearly that sense of the self on one side and everything else on the other side is one of the oppositions that Zen is interested in confounding. I remember a really beautiful and haunting talk that Joan gave many years ago up at Lake Pleasant. It's actually the retreat, I think, in 1998, where I first met Jen, where she was talking about the kind of pain of alienation and feeling somehow as a person that you're kind of outside of nature, or you're looking at it and you're not one with it, or you're separating from it, or you're separated from it. And she said in that context, she says, one thing that's certain is we'll lose everything we love, and everything we'll love will lose us. And she's talking there about dying and finitude and change. And very dramatically, she suggested that accepting that in a way was part of the process of losing that alienation, of not feeling, because everything else will die, everything else perishes. And if you really are thrown into that, maybe that separation is healed. It always reminds me of Robert Johnson, the blues singer, at least in the Lucinda Williams song, says about Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil so he could play guitar. You know, so he was the best guitar player of all time, and they said that he made a pact with the devil to do that. And it seems to me in a way that awakening is like that you sell your soul to the devil so you can play guitar. You know, that you give up in some way the notion that you're eternal, that you're separate, and after that, you get to play guitar. You know, you're in there with all the other things. So it seems to me in Zen that pretty clearly one of the things that we toss over to the other side is the self. We toss the self over to the side of things, and then we can feel sometimes, after all, what other side? Other side of what? Because once you've tossed, it doesn't seem, at least for a while, like there's another side anymore. And so subject versus object and self versus other and knower versus known can all seem to disappear, as we say, you know, tossed over to the other side. Other side of what? What other side? And so where I want to go with this tonight, though not at great length, is to suggest that koans are one of the really great ways in which that happens in Zen study. That in koan work, you really get tossed over to the other side. So you're on the same side as everything else. My experience anyway, and also working with people and work in the room, is that koan study for sure doesn't start that way. So there really is a sense that you're working on the koan. The koan's this funny object that you've been given. You're going to try and crack it open. You're going to try and break it. You're going to try and decipher it or break the code. But it really is in some sense, and I think now actually that this is part of what it does. It seems to you like an important object, partly because it's such a weird object. Do you know what I mean? If you pick up a can opener and you know what to do with it, then it's just a tool. But if you pick up something else and you have no idea how to use it, it's this kind of weird thing, and its thingness and not you-ness is pretty obtrusive. And certainly that was my experience working with koans for a long time. Kind of, what is this weird thing that I can't figure out what to do with? You know. But I think everybody has a fair amount of experience with this, and probably a lot, with some practice and with some patience, and a kind of wearing away of our resistance, something else begins to happen. And there really is a sense that the koan has tossed you over to the other side. And so rather than working on the koan, D.T. Suzuki says that in no or mu, we wake up in the space of the unconscious. And he doesn't mean the Freudian unconscious, but there's this weird sense of finding yourself all of a sudden awake in this strange place, this strange field. And my sense would be that that's what happens in koan work often, that after you've been doing it for a while, you kind of disappear as the one who's studying the koan and wake up or discover yourself inside the koan, where the koan is a story or an image or a vision or a space or a dream that's dreaming you, and you're inside it and you're kind of finding your way around it. And I think that really is a moment where you're tossed over to the other side, and then you start to say, well, you know, what other side of what, that you're just in that, that space. There's a beautiful phrase in a Wallace Stevens poem, it seems appropriate, where he says, you know, and there I found myself more truly and more strange. You know, kind of you're strange to yourself, and at the same moment you find yourself more truly as that strangeness. And I think that's part of sort of waking up in the field of the koan. So again, I think this is kind of, you know, preaching to the converted, but my sense would be that it might be really useful this weekend to feel our way into sitting with the koans this way as much as we can, that we just let ourselves sort of fall into a slumber, as it were, and wake up in the field of the koan and let ourselves be there. So here are the koans that are on the sheet that I thought, you know, maybe you could lie down with one tonight, sit with it tomorrow, and that we talked about during the koan seminar. They all seem to me to be good koans for finding that you've been tossed over to the other side, and then asking yourself, what other side of what? They're all ones that we've done before. So there's Weinang, quickly, quickly, without thinking good and evil, before your parents were born, what is your original face? And so I think the invitation here for this weekend, let's say, is to be with the koan, let it dream you, and see what happens if you wake up in the field of the koan. And the trick again would be not to figure out what it means, but to see if the koan can dream you as or into your own original face, so that you really could show it. So being thrown over to the other side in this instance might be to show your original face. And one of the things that might happen as you do that is you might wonder, you know, where or how does it come forth, and where did it come forth from? If it's there, what does it come up out of? So I won't comment on the other ones the same way, but here's some other ones that we've done before that I want to invite you to consider spending some time with in this spirit. This is the stone drenched with rain that points the way. Then Linji, that's Santoka, a 20th century haiku poet, and drunk, I think, apparently. Linji, there is a true person of no rank constantly coming in and out through the gates of your face. And here's another one that's from a Japanese folk story, I think. In the Sea of Issei, 10,000 feet down, lies a single stone. I want to pick up that stone without wetting my hands. And here's a poem by Dickinson that I think we've done together before, but I can't remember for sure. I know I talked about it at the Mahasangha retreat in Colorado 2 summers ago. I think it's a poem that tracks both the process and the effects of letting yourself be tossed over to the other side. And things open up progressively in the poem. So it starts in one place and ends, I think, in another place. A bird came down the walk he did not know I saw. He bit an angleworm in halves and ate the fellow raw. And then he drank a dew from a convenient grass, and then hopped sideways to the wall to let a beetle pass. He glanced with rapid eyes that hurried all around. They looked like frightened beads, I thought. He stirred his velvet head like one in danger. Cautious, I offered him a crumb, and he unrolled his feathers and rowed him softer home than oars divide the ocean, too silver for a seam, or butterflies off banks of noon leap splashless as they swim. It says splashless, but it's just a variant. He unrolled his feathers and rowed him softer home than oars divide the ocean, too silver for a seam, or butterflies off banks of noon leap plashless as they swim. And there I found myself more truly and more strange. What other side of what? So I think it's really important, and we've been talking about this a lot, to acknowledge that you won't, if you get tossed over to the other side, it's unlikely you'll spend all your time over there, though in another way you will, you know, you'll be changed by that. But you're going to come back to being a self and a knower. You can't eradicate that. You're going to come back. It certainly happens to me a lot with koan study. You know, I'm trying to crack the koan open and it's outside me and so on, and then I'll be back inside it and so on. And again, as we've been saying, I don't think there's anything wrong with that switchability and variability, you know, that sometimes you're on the side of the world and sometimes you feel separate and you're very aware of being a self and a knower and so on. And I think it's very normal to be sort of intermittently on one side or the other, and then sometimes to feel that both sides are actually there, you know. And I think one of the things to say about that is that that both and quality, if you're patient with it, is already a positive. Because if sometimes it's one way and sometimes it's the other and it oscillates between those two, eventually the boundary between those two will feel like it's you know, fuzzing up or being eradicated or getting blurry. And that's the moment again in which you might say, you know, other side of what, or what other side, or which side am I on now? Am I outside it or am I inside it? It reminds me of the Whitman thing that I love, where he says, him they immerse and he immerses them. So there's the poet in Whitman is either immersed in everything or he immerses everything. And what I have in my notes is actually the Maurice Sendak from the children's story about Mickey in the Night Kitchen, where he goes down and falls in the batter when he's trying to bake a cake, and he keeps saying, I'm in the milk and the milk's in me, I'm in the milk and the milk's in me. And I think with koan study, you have the feeling in a way, you know, maybe the koan, you're working on the koan and it's kind of inside you, is something you're thinking about, and at other times you find yourself in the field of the koan and then you're inside it. So the koan's in you or you're inside the koan. And again, I think there's nothing wrong with that both and quality, and that finally it serves to kind of wear away the difference between those two perspectives. I want to say also, and I'm almost done, but that both-and quality is characteristic of the body of the Buddha that we call the Sambhogakaya. So as against the Nirmanakaya, which is the sort of physical body that's bounded and different from other bodies, and John's not me and I'm not him, and neither one of us is the floor, and as against that other side where everything comes immediately out of the vastness and in some sense is just one. It's just vastness every place you look. In the Sambhogakaya, which is the realm of dreams and koans and parables and fables and night visions and so on, there's a sense sometimes of the boundaries between self and other beginning to blur, or the relation between you and another getting kind of topsy-turvy and so on. And I'm suggesting both that that happens in our work on koans, so we're outside them and we're inside them, and also very often, and I think, you know, the koans I'm giving tonight are good instances of that, that both and quality is true of the space inside the koan as well. So if you wake up inside the koan, you know, this is the stone drenched with rain that points the way. Are you looking at the stone? Are you being the stone? Are you being the rain? If you're in the Sea of Issei and you want to, there's a stone at the bottom 10,000 feet down, and you want to touch that stone without wetting your hands, are you the one who's going down into the water? Are you the one who doesn't have to go down into the water? Are you the stone at the bottom of the water? Are you the sand at the bottom that's holding the stone? Are you the water itself? And the kind of shiftiness among those things, that kind of fuzzing and blurring, is also a crucial part of the, you know, tossing it over to the other side of what other side? And so I would suggest that if you find things getting blurry or fuzzy when you're working on the koans, you don't need to be in any hurry to get yourself out of that. And then finally, and then I'm done, I guess I want to suggest that I don't think really, I mean, you can make a project of tossing yourself over to the other side, but I don't think usually that works or that's how it happens, that somehow the koan will do that to you. If you just spend enough time with the koan and get tired enough or wonky enough or whatever it is, then in some way you wake up inside it and your relation to it has really changed. I want to suggest anyway that you consider letting that happen this weekend and that you consider that it might be a good thing to do. And as I said, I think all of you are probably already doing it already, so you can disregard the talk because you already know it. You know. I guess we could spend a couple minutes if there are a couple questions or comments about it, and then let's walk and sit a little bit more. But,
What about tea? Are we going to do that?
Yeah, let's hold off on that for just a second. Okay. Oh, we can do tea tonight. Yeah, we should.
Yeah, we are.
But anyway, anything else about the talk before we give up on that for now?
No, other than the fact I can hear you speaking about this over and over again.
Oh, thank you.
Because it's part of what filters in. And,
great. You
know,
thank you.
It's helpful to me.
Great. Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, how are we going to have tea? Usually we don't have tea the first night, you know, but... So, let's do this. Let's walk for 5 minutes. Let's sit for 5 minutes. Then let's have tea and just sit quietly and drink our tea for 5 minutes. And then let's do the closing. I mean, just the setzen. Good?
Yeah.
All right, so let's walk a little bit then. Thank you.
Sure.